For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, and I'm very, very happy to have with us this morning my old friend Tonin O'Connor, very fine Soto Zen teacher at the Milwaukee Zen Center. Tonin and I went on a trip to China. First year I moved here to Chicago in 2007 and visited many old, famous old temples, Temple of Jiaozhou and Linji and Bodhidharma's temple, where that statue of Bodhidharma on our altar came from.
Oh, wonderful.
So anyway, Tonin is...
He came from...
yes. So anyway, thank you for coming down from Milwaukee, Tonin, and for speaking to us.
Okay. I'm really pleased to be here. Again, as Taigen mentioned, we're old friends and colleagues. And thank you all for coming. I appreciate it. Let me say this, please be comfortable. I much prefer talking to people who are comfortable enough to listen rather than to sort of statuary Buddhists or Buddhas who can't hear at all because they're in such pain. So please make yourself comfortable. I've chosen today with some sort of crazy daring, I think, to talk about two terms that are traditional within our understanding. And we seldom put them together because they're contradictory in a very big way, or conceivably so. So we sort of just don't mention it. And I ended up titling the talk, Can We Reconcile No Birth, Our Ephemeral, Transitory, Illusory Nature That's Constantly Changing, that is simply the product of the coming together of various events, with rebirth, which implies the rebirth of something. And it's very difficult to match with what we believe and understand to be the nature of our being. Because if my being is dependent upon the various conditions that brought it into place, and the Buddha said, when certain conditions come together, something arises. When the conditions dissipate, it goes away. We have death in here as a conclusion to the various events that are keeping us all here at the moment. So, and yet, both of these terms are traditional, they go way back. And I thought that rather than just sort of ignoring the difficulty, I would try to give you a sense of where I believe they arose, how they have been described, and how I feel about it. So what you're going to hear is my opinion. It is not revealed truth by any means, and I hope we'll have a good discussion about the matter. But I think it is important to us because each of those terms has a real impact on our lives and how we understand who we are and what we are. And yet they seem to be rather desperately contradictory. You know, if I am an event that comes into being at the intersection of conditions, I die, what is to be reborn? There are many ways of looking at that question. Some people believe in a kind of literal rebirth. You go through a 49-day bardo and you emerge as a new human being. But it's not you. It can't be you. So one of the things that has always puzzled me is our fascination with ideas of rebirth, sometimes even called reincarnation, which it cannot be, because incarnate means this person. If I reincarnate, I come back as Tonin, which seems to me not in the cards somehow. So what I really want to do is offer you a sort of personal take on this whole thing. What did I do with my watch? May I use yours, please? Where am I watching this? Here it is, ready to go. But I want to keep my eye on it so I don't talk too long. So I want to begin by sharing a discussion that took place in around 150 BC between the Buddhist monk Nagasena and the Indo-Greek king of northwest India, today's Pakistan, Menander I, known in Pali as Milinda. It's known as the Questions of Milinda. This Indo-Greek king had some real questions for the Buddhist monk about existence. And the dialogue, I think, goes straight to the heart of the questions we might have today. I'd like to dip into this account to sort of set the stage for the rest of our discussion. Nagasena's name, by the way, is very interesting. It can be translated as Army of Nagas or Host of Dragons. And here we are today at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, which seems entirely appropriate. But here, as I dip into it, is the discussion. The second thing after an introduction is the doctrine of not self. And King Milinda asked him, "How is your reverence known, and what is your name, sir?" "As Nagasena I am known, O great king, and as Nagasena do my fellow religious habitually address me. But although parents give such names as Nagasena, nevertheless, this word is just a denomination, a designation, a conceptual term, a current appellation, a mere name." And the king fires back. He says, "Well, now, if, most reverend, no person can be apprehended in reality, who then, I ask you, gives you what you require by way of robes, food, lodging, and medicines? Who is it that consumes them? Who is it that guards morality, practices meditation, realizes the four paths and their fruits, and thereafter nirvana? Who is it that commits the five deadly sins? For if there were no person, there could be no merit and no demerit, no fruit of good and evil deeds. O Venerable Nagasena, if someone should kill you, in this case, he would not commit any murder." As an aside, I would say, because you wouldn't be there. So what then is this Nagasena? And Nagasena explains by going into a very famous sort of metaphor and simile. He says, "As a king, you have been brought up in great refinement and you avoid roughness of any kind. If you would walk at midday on this hot, burning, and sandy ground, then your feet would have to tread on the rough and gritty gravel, and they would hurt you. Your body would get tired. How then did you come, on foot or on a mount?" "I did not come, sir, on foot, but on a chariot." So now Nagasena is going to take that chariot apart. He says, "Well, if you have come on a chariot, then please explain to me what a chariot is. Is the pole the chariot? No, reverend sir. Is then the axle the chariot? No, reverend sir. Is it then the wheels, or the framework, or the flagstaff, or the yoke, or the reins, or the goat stick? No, reverend sir. Then is it the combination of these things? No, reverend sir. Then is this chariot outside the combination of pole, axle, etc. No, reverend sir. Then, ask as I may, I can discover no chariot at all. Just a mere sound is this chariot. But what is the real chariot? Your majesty has told a lie. You have spoken a falsehood. There really is no chariot. But the king comes back and he says, I have not, Nagasena, spoken a falsehood, for it is independent on the pole, the axle, the wheels, the framework, the flagstaff, etc., that there takes place this denomination, chariot. This designation, this conceptual term, a current appellation and a mere name. So what he's saying is the chariot exists in what it does, in its pieces as they come together. When it is rolling along the road, it is a chariot. You take apart the pieces and all you have are pieces. This is a very famous example of how we fit into the universe. The universe at this moment is all of us. One person leaves the room, well, there's of course still a universe, it's not the same universe. We are all part of the activity of something. So he's defining something as the function that arises from things coming together. The legs that hold up the altar table, for instance. You take them off and they're just a piece of wood. But in there, that ensemble, if you will, is a table. Well, this is a very usual way of speaking about ourself. It is full of constantly changing components, but as they come together and as we act, we call it a self. So far, so good. But it goes right on immediately. The king asked, when someone is reborn, Venerable Nagasena, is he the same as the one who just died, or is he another? You notice he assumes rebirth. Doesn't really question it at all, because the idea of rebirth was deeply embedded in the culture at that time. It's very, very important within Hinduism, because as you purify yourself and you're reborn, you keep working to finally achieve unity with Brahma, the Godhead. So it's important, and it permeated the culture. So there's no question here in his mind, you know, you're reborn. But he wants to know how, who, what. My question, of course, is what is being reborn? This does not get asked here. It's kind of significant. Is he the same as the one who just died, or is he different? The elder replied, he is neither the same nor another. Give me an illustration. What do you think, great king, when you were a tiny infant, were you then the same as the one who is now grown up? And of course, the answer is no. And yet, what's being posed here is a kind of continuum, a continuity. None of us are the same as we were when we were 5 years old. And yet, we will identify a picture of that child as me at five. So although it's different, it's not the same. But there is a kind of ongoing because of cause and effect. You know, there's a sort of tie between things as they develop. So, there's a long discussion of what this baby could, might or might not do. So then, the king says, give me a simile. Quote, if a man were to light a lamp, could it give light throughout the whole night? Well, yes, it could. Is now the flame which burns in the first watch of the night the same as the one that burns in the second? Well, no, it is not the same. Or is the flame which burns in the second watch the same as the one which burns in the last one? It is not the same. Do we then take it that there is one lamp in the first watch of the night, another in the second, etc., etc.? No, 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 no. It is because of just that one lamp that the light shines throughout the night. Even so, we must understand the collocation of a series of successive dharmas. And then he leaps, Nagasena. At rebirth, one dharma arises while another stops, but the two processes take place almost simultaneously, i.e. they are continuous. Now here's our problem. He assumes that, you know, I die instantly, simultaneously, my ingredients, if you want to call them that, arise in a new being. And he ignores, of course, the big question, which you will see. He says, therefore, the first act of consciousness in the new existence is neither the same as the last act of consciousness in the previous existence, nor is it another, because it bears some of the factors of that first one. He ignores the gap, which is death. Because if there is the death of one set of components, we have a gap. Let's say we break down the altar into its pieces, okay? Well, it's going to rise again, we're going to repair it. It'll come back as a new altar. But there is a gap during that period of time. It ends. And so there is a kind of ignoring of the fact that is very apparent, and yet we all prefer to ignore it. We don't very much like the idea of death. And so the example of the flame works only within a, how should I put it, an existing continuum. There can't be a break. Plus, we often use the idea of, I have a candle here with a flame, so now I'm going to pass it to a new candle, light the candle from my flame. That is not me. There is energy passed. And often when we face this kind of conundrum, Buddhists will say, well, there's some kind of energy, you know, we know in science that energy is never lost, that goes on and is reborn. And I'll get back to that in a minute, because I have a particular idea about how that can be understood. But as the pure reemergence of something deeply connected to what went before, there's this gulf called death. And it's also interesting that in the beginning of the Buddhist teachings and in the early scriptures, the clearly expressed goal of the Buddha was to show us how to stop revolving on the painful wheel of life and end the suffering inherent in our constant becoming. The idea, early idea, was that nirvana was the cessation of this endless returning into misery. Here's a quote from the Samyutta Nikaya. It says, if monks, a monk's mind has become dispassionate by being liberated, it is steady. By being steady, it is content. By being content, he is not agitated. Being unagitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands, destroyed is birth, the spiritual life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. Well, somehow, over all these thousands of years, we've lost a little bit of our sight of that goal. We enjoy it if we think psychologically. I want to get off the wheel of life, these various six states of misery. And so if I arrive at a kind of equanimity, well, then I'll be off the wheel. But originally, it was quite literal. At the same time, we haven't been able to shake off our fascination with the idea of rebirth, both as a result of its being connected to the idea of karma, and another idea I'll get to in a minute. Karma is was originally a system of reward and punishment that may need to carry over into many lives to reach resolution. Also, in early Buddhism, the assumption was it was so hard to become awakened that it would take you many lifetimes. This was a long, 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 long process. And in that process, they were explaining, I think, the thing that bothers all of us is, why does some evil person live such an apparently peaceful life, rich life, and a person who's terribly good gets struck down by some kind of tragedy? It's the old question of, you know, why do good people suffer? And it was resolved by suggesting that karma may not be resolved now in this life. It, you know, later on, two, three lives down the road. And this is maybe why you're born into misery, because somewhere back there, there was something that has been trailing you. It was a useful understanding, still held by many, because karma, which is sort of, we reap the fruits of our actions, all religions that I know anything about have what I call a kind of social compact portion, which is something in terms of reward or punishment that keeps us from, frankly, tearing each other limb from limb. I mean, it resolves a lot of those things because we will be punished if we do X, Y, or Z. And for me, let's just digress for 1 second here because I'm doing it right on time. Karma can be understood a bit differently, and it has been by some contemporary Japanese teachers, including Koto Sawaki Roshi, who died in 1965. And I agree that what I do changes who I am. I may not go to prison for what I've done, but if I steal something, I am a thief. That's it. So we are internally affected. We become what we do. So that, again, a good person who is really trying to help everyone is a good person. That does not mean they may not lose their job or, you know, all kinds of awful things happen. So it isn't a question of, if I have the goal of getting this reward, now I'll be good, which is way off track. But it is a question of, if I wish to be helpful to people, just because that feels right, then I am a good person. And we can know that. But we are changed by what we do. That, for me, is immediate karma. It's sometimes good actions bring visible good results to us, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes a bad action brings an immediate punishment. I remember I used to work in the prison system a lot, and I remember being in a group, and there was a guy there who was in for homicide. And he said to the group, I don't know how I can ever resolve the fact that I killed someone. Well, the other guy said, well, you're here. Instant karma. You know. But we, you know, it isn't something that is sort of mechanically predictable. But anyway, my feeling is all of this feeds into our very deepest desire, which is to not end. It's fairly easy to suggest that myself is a moving target. It's really a response mechanism. It's affected by everything. It's changing all the time. I'm aging. I can sort of get that. And then we get right up against the end. And I've asked myself here in what I've written, have you ever actually tried to visualize, to conceptualize being nothing? It's impossible. Our minds can only grasp something, nor can they conceive of not being. You know, consciousness can't imagine its own absence. So what we end up doing, we fear death because it's a mystery. We can't get there. We don't know what happens. What really happens is we start making up things, because it's very important to us to feel we're going to continue. It's more powerful in some religions than in Buddhism. But certainly the idea of rebirth feeds into my desire to just not go away. I will feel I'm not important if I just go away. Why was I here? And rebirth sort of takes the sting out of the whole thing. And we're quite happy to accept it. Blotting out in our minds this little gulf called, she died. You know, how we get across that. There are, there's an old tradition that it takes 49 days to cross that gulf. The bardo in the Tibetan tradition. And in our Japanese tradition, There is a ceremony on the 49th day after death to sort of urge the person forward. But so far, I've been quoting early Theravada scripture, the very earliest scripture. So what about Zen? I feel that Zen, with our understanding that awakening is immediately available to us. I mean, if reality is here, somehow I should be able to experience it, as opposed to going through many lifetimes and eons of practice and study and turning myself into something. And Zen also understands that the only time we can really know is the present moment. Actually, even that literally isn't here. It's so brief. But we don't say much in Zen about rebirth, because we're very fixed on searching for how to live this moment with the sense it's all I have. And we're here today in this room. This is it. And it's been said that eternity is a succession of nows. It's always now. It's never then, except in our memories or our speculation. And so I remember being asked one time to speak as part of an interfaith panel on, you know, is there life after death? And I went off to my Zen sources. I found very little reference. Once in a while, a kind of casual reference that suggested that, yes, they believed in rebirth because that was sort of the cultural thing. You know, it just went by. Not the examination of it or the clinging to it you found in other traditions. Because I think if we are practicing Zen, we're trying to live now and make it as deep as we can, knowing that the horizontal line has this little truncation at the end. So to go into this, I think, and this is just my personal opinion, that the only way we can reconcile no self and rebirth is not as the rebirth of an individual self. I just can't really get there. But as a continuing process of interaction that means everything in the universe is being reborn each instant. There is a Zen saying that you're reborn with every breath. Also, if you breathe in and you don't breathe out, it's all over. And that's it's absolutely true. And each time you breathe out, it's a new person, if you will. So there is this constant rebirth within the envelope of my life on this planet. So, you know, I put here, I would like to use the word, everything is borning. It's not being reborn, it's birthing. It's not rebirth, it's constant birthing. And it has no beginning and end, this process. And in the early text was known as the unborn. Koto Sawaki, whose work I'm translating, calls it the non-born, which is very, very interesting. The Yodana scripture, which is an early one, says, quote, there is, monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned. If, monks, there were no unborn, unbecome, unmade, unconditioned, no escape would be discerned from what is born, become, made, conditioned. The only way you can escape from the conditioned is to go into something that is not, or assume there's something there that is not. The 7th century Chinese Zen master, Yoka Genkaku, in Japanese, known as Yoka Daishi, expressed it thus in a long poem called The Song of Awakening. Who is no thought? Who is non-born? If non-birth is true, not even no birth exists. If there just isn't birth, you can't say there is something that is non, this thing that is not there. If birth does not exist, neither can its opposite, no birth. What is being spoken about here, I feel, is the eternal, endless life of absolute existence, which has neither beginning nor end, according to Buddhist thinking. It just is. Yet its life includes both the Big Bang and the receding nature of our own cosmos. Sawaki says, Yoga Daishi says again, how many times have I been born? How many times have I died? Birth and death come and go without end. Yet suddenly, when one understands the non-born, one doesn't rejoice at praise, one isn't distressed by blame. And Kota Sawaki Roshi comments, non-born signifies that it has not had birth and therefore cannot have death. It has not had birth, therefore it cannot have death. To be born implies to die, just as production implies destruction. And this is the source of another Zen saying, which is no birth, no death. So, at the same time, I mean, I was born on April 5th, 1932, and 2-3 years from now, I will end. So what is beginningless and endless? Does not come and go, appear or disappear, is not born, and does not die. This is the mystery, for me anyway, of ongoing infinite existence, seen as a kind of process that has always been working, will continue as far as we know to always work. But for it to happen, it could continue only because it is made up of finite existences, like you and me, that are arising and disappearing. Because if you think about it, motion is coming and going and coming and going. So this infinite existence, if its components, if you will, were not the endless arising and perishing of everything, it would just, I don't know, be there. Nothing would happen. Mm-hmm. So within these finite existences, whose arising and disappearing constitute the very nature of the whole that is infinity. In this sense, my beginning and my end are essential to what Zen calls the beginningless beginning and the endless end. Within the beginning that never did begin, the end that will never come, are all of our own beginnings and ending. They're essential. The universe will not function if we don't come and go. So our going is a contribution to the life of the universe. And so we also need to think about the fact that myself rises into existence on the foundation of millions of lives that went before. Millions of lives that went before. And everything I do, each action, each thought, each breath, generates a limitless series of responses. No limit to it. So as a component of the whole, I am indeed unborn and undying. And although this self, the thing I call me, will cease at its death, I will have generated limitless births of other events. In this sense, we can say there is rebirth, or better said, endless birthing. And even more interestingly, this is only possible because of my transient nature as no self, endlessly forming and reforming, and therefore not a fixed, solid obstruction to the process. So the idea of no self, transient temporary selves, and a constant birthing of events can go together. Where it falls down is when we identify rebirth as me. Some piece of me comes back. I love the idea, but it doesn't hold up. Interestingly enough, very briefly, you know, the Buddha said we need to try to experience things ourselves, test them. I think we can test the idea of no self, the transient nature of ourselves. If you try to find your mind, for instance, you can't. I mean, lots of luck. And you realize that you know, a little bio you have on a piece of paper isn't you. And yet, you know, you're this. For me, myself is a response mechanism. I mean, this talk might be different to a slightly different group. I will give it again, because I'm lazy, in Milwaukee next week. And it will be a little different group of people. But we can do that. But rebirth, I can't experience. I can't test it. It's a really lovely idea. Just as heaven is a lovely idea and other religious traditions. But I can't get there. So for me, what is helpful is that my lack of a fixed self and my birth and my death are essential to the ongoing, endless process of birthing. That's what I'm offering you. What do you think? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Sort of imaginatively, I can speculate how I would understand how rebirth might work. Mm-hmm. Not as a literal reincarnation, but that after conditions change, you die, most of what you are has ceased. And you would speculate that karmic seeds, the predilections created in your mind or your life, somehow there's continuity until you're reattached to some other physical form. But you have to speculate about that and go, well, okay, well, where is that realm within which there's continuity? And you can only, it becomes a matter of faith because you can't experience that. But even emotionally for me, while there is that continuity, even on traditional terms, what would carry over is no memories, no knowledge carried over, no personality, no emotions, but just these impersonal predilections, these tendencies that have been created during life. And that is so impersonal that you're going to go, okay, it carries over, kind of, so what?
So what? Because I won't, you know, I won't recognize it. I'm not there anymore. I do think that's why for me, when I say, you know, what everything I do goes on forever.
Yeah.
If you think, as you describe, karmic seeds, but you know, all of our actions and thoughts and so on have an impact. Well, that just rolls on forever. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who calls it the ripple effect. Well, we're here because of the ripple effect, and then you know, we create more ripples. I find it easier to imagine that than to sweat to try to put myself into the scenario. I can't do it. Yes?
Yeah. Hearing what you say about the predispositions and that sort of karmic continuity, in a sense, if all I'm worried about is Roy, and then Roy being reborn and picking up those things, you know, yeah, it would be very impersonal, but at the same time, if I see that there really is no birth, there is no Roy, that Roy is a figment, you know, a great aggregation of things right now that works, it's a useful concept, but that at a deeper sort of essential level, there is no essential Roy there, then I do sort of care that predisposition because it's not just about me, it's about all of us, it's about the entire universe. And so do I really want to dump bad predispositions on the rest of the universe, or rather, you know, is it back to the Eightfold Path of, you know, right life, right effort, all those things that then carry forward into everything?
Right on. We are responsible for the universe because we are the universe, sort of like it or lump it.
Yes. I understand the sort of tension between the ideas of rebirth and non-self, and I think that the way that you handle the notion of rebirth is quite elegant, quite beautiful, and useful. But at the same time, I ask myself if the process is entirely a necessary one, in the sense that, as you said towards the end of your talk, you know, the Buddha encourages us to be empirical. And over the course of my practice life or whatever, I feel that I do, or whatever, have a sort of an empirical sense of what non-self is. And it is absolutely an integral part of my life as a Zen student. My life as a Zen student is kind of unimaginable without it, and you know, it really seems like part of the picture. On the other hand, the idea of rebirth, what I think about that and how I resolve sort of philosophically any potential paradox or conflict actually seems to, when I think about it, I can't imagine how it would touch my practice life very much one way or the other.
And
that's maybe the reason that we don't hear a lot about it in our tradition, because that may be in part the conclusion of previous people as well.
I think that's exactly right. You know, for me as a person and a Zen practitioner, my answer is, who cares? I mean, so what? I can't know it. And this is why I think within Zen literature, nobody talks about it. Why would you talk about it? But I only brought it up because there's a powerful stream that, in which the full Buddhist tradition continues to worry about rebirth. But I think you're absolutely right. The real question is, what can I empirically understand? And all the rest of that is just hooey, so why bother? But I think the why bother, it's also interesting for me anyway, to understand that I bother because I so badly wish to continue, which is something I need to work with, if you will, as a Zen practitioner, to sort of try to let that one go and just say, you're not gonna, honey, so forget it. Listen, I'm 82, so it's kind of right out there. But yes, I agree with you 100%. I think empirically and for our practice, this is where we live in this moment, and the rest of that is just speculation.
On the other hand, the part of rebirth that I think is relevant for us, it's not personal rebirth, but from the point of view of the Bodhisattva practices, what exactly what you were saying, how does our practice, our life, our effort make a difference long-term? And part of what I value in our practice, in our tradition is, you know, you're quoting Nagasena, or, you know, just this long-term vision that, you know, if we think about how we're going to make an effect in the world, in our life, we can feel kind of overwhelmed and hopeless. But if we think of rebirth in terms of our culture, in terms of our lineages, in terms of our traditions, then we are part of something that it does endure and that does have a sustainable, rebirth isn't exactly the right word, but it does have a...
It has an impact.
Why use that word?
Yeah, so I don't. But
tradition, lineage, the fruits of bodhisattva activity, etc.
But something of our effort is reborn in the world in other ways, that's all.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, to me the important thing is that everything I do has impact, whether I know it or not. And if we are trying to follow a bodhisattva ideal, then look before you leap. I mean, think before you act as much as you can. I had an experience very briefly in Japan many, many years ago. I used to work in the theater, and in the early 80s, I was traveling a lot to Japan because my theater company was touring to Japan. So as a manager, I was going across all the time. And that was fine. And at that time, particularly in Japan, you know, women weren't leaders of big theater companies. And I would say 5 or 6 years after that little flurry of activity, I was still going back. And I met a young woman who I thought was just, I was astonished by her activity. She had created her own theater company. They were doing very forward-looking avant-garde work. Her husband, who was an actor, was working, if you will, for her in this company. She'd gotten quite a reputation, which is how people brought me to meet her. And we met, and I said, I think what you're doing is fabulous. She said, you know, it's all because of you. I said, what? She said, well, we met briefly when you're first here. I suppose in some group, you know. And she said, I thought, well, women can do things. Now, I hadn't a clue. You know, when you're suddenly confronted with somebody who says your presence or some idle word you said meant something to them, it's a little hint at what's going on here and how we should, as much as possible, pay attention to the path. I mean, that's our eternity, really, is the impact we have. So. Yes,
Carol.
Yeah, I liked your teaching. You know, it impacted me very much, and it kind of, you know, gave me the opportunity to realize that, you know, like, you know, a rebirth and a death, there's like a coming together, and there's like light, and then you have the shadows, and it gives you an opportunity not to just put something behind you, you know, but to just continue and, you know, in the shadows, you know, you have this darkness and it's an opportunity for self-reflection, and then you have the light and you have the shadows, and it's kind of, it gives you an opportunity to come together and get in tune with, like, your inner self. So, yeah.
We need to know who we are as much as we can.
Thank you.
Yes, patient.
What I was going to say is, you know, it seems like who we are is so much a convention. You know, when I just was so, you said it so eloquently about, you know, the ways in which we impact innumerable beings and activities, and even your example just now, you know, just kind of always remind me in my practice life that I'm not even me. You know, it's all this stuff that's happening, and it could change any time, and yet we do have conventions. You know, because I don't know how else to live in a, you know, four-dimensional reality without thinking that, you know, I'm going to have to eat if I want to, you know, live tomorrow or things like that. But so to me, it seems like sometimes, you know, some of these things are real and empirical and understandable, and then some of them are conventions, like, you know, that this is me. You know, you're still, or, you know, connected in some ways to, like, the six-year-old version of you, but, you know, as we all are. And so, you know, so it always brings back to me the idea that, you know, who we are right now, we don't even really know. Yeah. We can try, but...
And in a certain sense, I think, if you try too hard to know who you are, you're solidifying it.
Yeah.
You're freezing it into a freeze frame. By the time you finish thinking about it, you're probably different. and you've got this nice picture of who I am. What I always liked, Nagarjuna's understanding that there is an ultimate reality, which is this no fixed existence of anything, of any kind, and a conventional reality, which says, I'm sitting here, at this table, speaking to you. And we live in the conventional world. It's useful, though, for me to understand the ultimate nature of who I am. Even though I feel, if I have a, you know, a pain in my foot, it feels quite real to me. And it is real in the conventional sense. I find the understanding of no fixed self very helpful as I go along. But like all of you, I eat and I sleep and I, you know.
Take vitamins.
Yeah, you bet.
Yes. Right. It's making me, the whole discussion, but also to where we are in the discussion right now, is making me think about sort of what it means to give a talk like this. You know, when you were first talking, it was like, oh, this is quite philosophical. You know, it's really engaging like a certain part of the self, you know, in order to just engage with the material, because it is sort of, as Niyo-san was saying, sort of further from practice or from immediate experience. And yet, you know, I feel like this whole discussion for me is an example of, you know, the usefulness of engaging with these kinds of questions, and just engaging with them, you know, that there isn't really sort of an end point that you come to, but I think, you know, it's like, what's the point of talking about things that you can't see or feel? But it's that there are all these assumptions that are sort of embedded into our conditioned way of experiencing our lives. And so that thing that you're talking about, like, there is this death, you know. Like, what do we make of this?
Yeah.
Like, you know, can we hang out with this, you know, question a little bit, you know, just to kind of start breaking up some of those assumptions that do contribute to our conditioning, and, you know, and they do contribute to that sort of sense of tension that we have about holding on to this fixed self, even if we don't believe in a fixed self, but we feel it
strongly.
As if it's never going to end.
I think it's really important to not deny or put aside stuff as philosophical thinking if the thinking actually streams into my life as I live it. And then it's on the cushion, or in sitting often, that I verify or fully understand things. I think, for me, sitting Zazen and the philosophy like a circle. I mean, they fulfill each other. Neither one alone is sufficient. But particularly in this case, you know, we were dealing with a concept that, as you say, is embedded in our culture, and maybe it's not very useful. So, there's somebody else.
Joe. Yeah.
I really liked your concept of birthing, birthing happening in every breath. And sometimes it feels like I notice something about myself that surprised me. It's like, huh? Who's that? Where did that
Yeah, that's great.
And so I'm just wondering if, in a way, if the practice is just about kind of guiding the direction a little bit of that birthing, so that you're trying to guide it in a good direction.
Yes, I think so, very strongly, because Dogen said in his essay, Buddha Nature, essentially that we are Buddha Nature. It's not some little seed inside us that we sort of promote. Well, if I am Buddha Nature, or if everything is Buddha Nature, then we're stuck with the problem of, what about all the bad things that happen? And personally, I've sort of come to the understanding that, yes, everything, including the bad stuff, is Buddha Nature. But my question for myself is, what kind of Buddha Nature do I want to be? How do I contribute in a bodhisattva way to make the full soup, if you will, taste right? So you're exactly right, I think. We have choice, which we now know there's some other critters that do to some extent, but basically we're the only creature that has an infinity of choices, and that makes our life complicated. But still, I think we choose and we direct a little bit as best we can. I've often wished I were a tree, because when the wind blows, if there's a heavy wind, a tree can bend, it can break, or it can withstand the storm. That's kind of it. And yet, when I get up in the morning, I have 40,000 million little mini choices to be made. Do I get up on my right foot or my left foot? It's just,
Laurel.
Thank you so much for your talk. It was very helpful to me to have you say these things out loud that we all know, but we don't think about. We're all going to die, and we really don't like that.
Nope.
But see you so sincerely talking about coming to terms with that is very helpful to me, so thank you very much.
I think... I talked to someone yesterday at the Zen Center because we had morning practice and then actually a book discussion, but I talked a little bit about what I was going to say here. And he used the phrase, every day is a good day to die. Meaning, it can happen any day. But the trick is, have I done up to now, with the best of my ability, everything I can do? Because the one thing I don't want to do is die thinking, oh, I haven't yet, oh, I should have, oh, I didn't. Be able to say, okay, it doesn't mean I have done everything I should, but to the best of my ability, I've been here all the time. And that's partly influenced by the fact that my mother died at the age of 57 or 58 of cancer, and I was 22, and in the 1950s, she was sent home to die. They couldn't do anything. It was ovarian cancer. They couldn't do anything about it. So my father and I did all of the end-of-life care. I mean, we were the hospice, if you will. And the very last thing, she's been a very active and interesting person, the very last thing she said before she went into the final sort of coma absolutely changed my life. And of course, we have no way of knowing what was in her mind. But what she said was, I've got to figure it out. Don't wait. Don't, and I mean, it changed who I was quite radically. I said, oh, don't wait. Start now. Looking at your life, living it fully. So in a way, our knowledge that we're finite, which, as far as I know, most other creatures do not have. I had an old cat who just expired at almost 20. She just faded away, absolutely unaware of, or in any kind of angst about what was going on. But the fact that we know we're going to die can help us really use the time we have. If you know it's not limitless, you don't put things off. And so you have a deeper life. And it's kind of nice.
So I just wish human beings would think of ourselves that way too, because we as a species are only here for a short time.
Yeah.
We've only been here for a short time.
Yep.
We're not going to be here for that much longer. And I feel like we're not paying attention.
No, we're not.
And doing what we can do in our time in the universe.
I think it's a profound wish. We're not doing what we should do in our time in the universe. We're kind of off track most of the time, self-absorbed. So we're again back, I think, to the Zen question.
That's why I'm a Buddhist.
Yeah, you know, it for me it comes right around to that. But I'm too busy looking at myself to pay attention to the reality of it.
Yes.
How did your multi-faith dialogue go? How did that? Because you're sitting around all the religions and
yep.
all like
yep.
after death this is gonna happen and this is gonna happen mm-hmm. right after this and then
yep.
you're like, doesn't matter, so don't worry about it. That would have been such a difficult pitch to like.
Well, it is.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And particularly the, you know, there was I think a Catholic and there was a Muslim and the Muslim said, of course, very clearly, you know, we believe in a last judgment and an afterlife. Okay. I don't remember exactly what I said, but generally what I will say is that within Buddhism, you know, some traditions believe in some sort of rebirth that, for me personally, and maybe as a Soto Zen Buddhist, I believe that everything I do impacts everything, and that goes on forever, but not as me. And people kind of go, what? And then we go on to the next person on the panel. It's a terrible pitch. I mean, who cares if everything I do affects everything if I'm not here? Is what, you know, you can read it behind their eyes.
Because I had a friend who lost a friend recently. Mm-hmm. And really, really sudden. It was a very sudden, dramatic experience, this person. And when she came to ask me a question, she wanted reassurance about, and I was like, oh, yeah, you know. Like, I think my thing was that, and I had this conversation with my grandma the other day, because she's 90, and she's, you know, been telling me, oh, I'm not how much longer I'm going to be here, you know, things like that. And I almost want to say, I just had a friend who lost someone who was 20-something. And I don't think you're any closer to death than I am.
Yep.
Or anything, because every breath could be the last one. I don't really know. I don't think age is really a determining factor of like when you're going to die. I don't think that. But I think it's sad that we wait until that long to realize that death is imminent. You know, I mean, I think that it kind of takes a death of your own age to realize that. You know, so.
Because otherwise, if you're, say, a teenager, you feel eternal. In fact, you may hate the fact that you're eternal, but there you are, you know. It's often only when sort of physical things start happening, whenever it is for each of us, we begin to realize that we're mortal, you know, something's changing that we can't change back. But for me, the idea that I can be, even though I don't know it, of use by whatever it is that's, you know, my actions create, is very comforting.
Yeah.
And I, because of my age, I read the obits in the paper a lot. I'm usually trying to see if they died a lot older than I now am. Horribly distressed if they, you know, died at 20 or whatever. You know. But what I found is the person who writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the you know, the more extensive obituary, I don't know exactly how she finds them, but they're not all well-known people by any means. But you find all of a sudden some ordinary guy who worked in a factory all his life, but did these things for his family, did these things for his neighborhood, you know, that people can make huge contributions that have nothing to do with, as Dogen sneered, fame and gain.
Mm-hmm.
It's living a life that is engaged with where you are and who you are. So, I mean, I love reading them because I think, my goodness, I never knew. Sometimes they had an amazing hobby, or sometimes they, one guy used to make sure that everybody in the neighborhood, particularly older people's lawns, were cut. That's a huge gift, you know?
Yeah.
You never heard of him. He worked at Alice Chalmers all his life on the line, maybe, but it's a wonderful thing. So, I'll be there.
Thank you. That's a wonderful note to end on.